ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नारायणं नमस्कृत्यं नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जाय मुदीरये नष्टप्रायेषु अभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवतीरुत्तम श्लोके भक्तिर्भवती नैष्टिकी. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 24, entitled Worshipping Govardhan Hill, Text 22 and then 23. Sattvam rajastama iti sthiti utpati antahetava rajas utpadyate vishvam anyonyam vividham jagat. Translation by the disciples of His Divine Rishi Lesi Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation: the causes of creation, maintenance and destruction. We read text number 23. Rajasa chodita megha varshanti ambuni sarvataha prajaistair eva siddhyanti mahendraha kim karishyati. Rajasa chodita megha varshanti ambuni sarvataha prajaistar eva siddhyanti mahendraha kim karishyati. Rajasa chodita megha varshantyambuni sarvatah prajastair eva siddhyanti mahendra kim karishyati. Mahendra kim karishyati. Atajis Rasa chodita megha janti ambuni sarvata janti Mahendra kim karishyati. Mahendra kim karishyati rajasa by passion, chodita impelled, megaha the clouds, varshanti pour down, ambuni their water, sarvataha everywhere, prajaha the population, tai by that water, eva simply, siddhanti maintain their existence, Maha Indraha, the great Indra. Kim, what? Karishyati, can do. Translation and purport by the disciples of His Divine Grace, Śrīla Bhaktivedānta Swami Śrīla Prabhupāda. Translation. Impelled by the material mode of passion, the clouds pour their rain everywhere. And by this rain, all creatures gain their sustenance. What has the great Indra to do with this arrangement? Purport. Lord Krishna continues His mechanistic explanation of existence, concluding, Mahendra Kim Karishyati. Who needs the great Indra? Since the rain sent by the clouds, which in turn are impelled by the mode of passion, is actually producing everyone's food. The word Sarvataha indicates that the clouds magnanimously send their rain even on the ocean, rocks and barren land, where there is no apparent necessity for such sweet water. Om Agyan Timirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupaha Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutha Padakamalam Shri Gurum Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhamvitamscha Namam Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Nitinamine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshitarine Namo Mahavadanyaya Krishna Prema Pradayate Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namane Gauratishe Namaha Panchatatvatmakam Krishnam Bhaktarupa Swarupakam Bhaktavataram Bhaktakyam Namami Bhakta Shaktikam He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpataru Bhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhyayevacha Patita Nam Pavane Bhyo Vaishnave Bhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nitya Nanda Shri Advaita Gudadhar Srivastri Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Seeking the blessings of all the exalted devotees here, as we are discussing this wonderful chapter of worshipping Govardhan Hill, and over the past days, the emphasis of the purports are towards how Krishna is emphasizing or overemphasizing the performance of duty, and it's as the only cause that will create the effect of consequences or consequences, and that karma theory is supreme, work is worship. In fact, Krishna is emphasizing workship, that the only ship to your destination is your workship. If you do your work nicely, you will reach to your desired destination. The winds will be forced to blow your way if you sail your ship. So this is what and also Krishna is explaining the divisions of work. Not every work will be of the same category. There will be the variety, there will be the various divisions in activities which will create its resultant consequences. And he's explaining about the duties of a Kshatriya, a Vaishya, Brahman, and a Kshatriya, and a Vaishudra, concluding with the duties of Vaishya order. And yesterday, Rohini Nandan Prabhu was explaining very nicely about the duties of a Vaishya, especially since all the other duties are finished, are not even existing, very, very marginally. Farming, commerce, crop protection. So you're saying now the last resort is money lending. That's what the whole world is running on, money lending, borrowing rates. People are discussing about economy in terms of the bank loan rates, loan rates and everything else, interest rates. So this is what is Kali Yuga. The Vaishya occupation will be limited only to lending money, which is a very dangerous occupation. Practically, the West, compared to the Indian subcontinent or the Japanese economies, Japanese economies and Indian economy are resting on savings economies. That means they rest on family culture, where the tradition is to save money. Statistics given by Angus Madison, he discovered India's economic history for the last, not India, the world economic history for the last 2000 years, has to conclude that even in the surveys given that 23% of this India's countries as savings as a whole is of 39% of the total savings of India, 23% is belonging to the family savings. While in the West, 9.8 crores of people have 12.8 crores of credit cards. That means more than one credit card per person. And that makes the money lending program very easy, but very miserable in the consequences. And the entire American economy is like $1.3 or $4 trillion in debt. While India still has a savings economy, and India still doesn't need forest investment flow. It can sufficiently generate its own resources to drive its own engine of growth. Unlike other nations which depend on war cultures so that their economy of military industrial complex can progress. The whole pastime of Krishna appearing on this planet Earth is because of mother cow, taking the bhumi taking the shape of mother cow, going to Lord Brahma and begging. And Prabhupada mentions here that the burden of earth was very much intensified by Kamsa like military rulers, dictators, which are running military industrial complexes like today what we are seeing. Therefore Krishna had come to decrease the burden of these tyrannic rulers. So therefore Krishna appears in the family of Kshatriyas, but he performs his pastimes in the family of Vaishyas. The Leela of Vrindavan was performed as a Vaishya, as a son of Vaishya, Nanda Maharaj. So he performed his duties. In fact, he himself shows his life, how he used to rigorously tend the cows, worship the cows and take care of them. And when it was the time to take the role of a Kshatriya, Lord Krishna took the role of a very powerful ruler who disciplined these tyrannic rulers. And today in this verse, Krishna is talking as a Brahmana. Right? When it comes to philosophy, he is presenting himself as a role of a Brahmana, where he is talking about the karma mimamsa of philosophy. So Krishna has played all the roles as a Brahmana, as a Kshatriya, as a Vaishya. And in this philosophy, he is explaining the philosophy of mechanistic science. So today, something of the Brahmanas of today who explain this science. How is Krishna corroborating with this science very accurately? At the same time, he is in principle speaking this philosophy to prove the bhakti science. He is speaking the mechanistic explanation of science to prove the bhakti science. So how is that? Is one nice article by Bhaktisiddhanta Sri Maharaj's disciple OBL Kapoorji. He has written a very nice article on the science of bhakti. And he explains that in a typical scientific world community, their whole emphasis is on observation and experiment, right? While in bhakti, it is propagated or propounded as it's a blind faith and absolute surrender of human reason and will. But in the scope of bhakti, man who doubts is doomed. Samshayatma vinashyati. But the whole progress of science rests on doubting. The science progresses only when there is doubt and logic and reason. And therefore, sometimes bhakti is labeled as backwardness and escapism from realities. Because it is blind faith, absolute surrender, and no doubting. So Krishna is to explain this, bhakti science. In this one sense, if you just see objectively science would definitely is a whole process of studying objects or matter in isolation of the entirety around it. If you want to understand a matter, an object, then you have to isolate that matter from its other mixed forms. And you isolate that matter from the mixed forms, and then you subject it to various experiments and understand the behavior of that object with the reaction. And then when the behavior is according to a set pattern, then laws are formulated. So in this case, in the bhakti science, how is the bhakti a science? In bhakti science also, there is the object of research, which is the self, the atma. And that atma also, according to the scientific view, is in mixed form. The self is mixed with the body. So if you have to understand the atma, you have to isolate that atma in its pure form and then subject it to reality and then subject it to the experiment. And the bhakti experiment, the experiment or the reaction of the soul is with God, Krishna. That is bhakti. So now the reaction of the action of the soul in relationship to Krishna is going to be the behavior. He has to understand the behavior and then laws are formulated in bhakti sciences. So it's a similar concept that is explained. But the typical objection to this way of science would say that it's so difficult to explain the human nature and to really put that human nature to experiment that people ridicule that which is too difficult to even experiment. So they are very afraid of experimenting with themselves. They are very easy to experiment with others, matter. So easy to manipulate matter than to change the age-old association of the soul, that the extraneous, all the impurities attached to it is very difficult. So now, comparing the mechanistic science with the bhakti science, we have reached the conclusion that just as our object need to be isolated in discussion, similarly the atma also too has to be isolated and purified in relationship to the absolute truth. So now, we'll see that there are two presumptions where science has to testify. The first is that how far it has succeeded in understanding the nature of that object. That would conclude whether the science has reached its conclusion of an object or not. How far it has understood the object in discussion. And secondly, how far the laws that are discovered are necessary or absolute. Do they become redundant in the process of the progress of science? If the laws don't become pertinent, then there is no point in going for a research. So therefore, the first thing is judging this question that we have to discuss this two presumptions with related to the bhakti science and the mechanistic science. I am sorry if I am going too technical into the science. As such, morning time is already too heavy with the bhakti science, and then mechanistic science is something which is already very difficult to comprehend. And yet we are trying to understand the mechanistic science because Krishna is explaining it. And the Nand Maharaj and all the coward boys, of course, they also do not want to hear this philosophy. But Krishna is nevertheless explaining this philosophy to bring the glory of bhakti. Right? So because it is meant to glorify bhakti, by which Krishna is going to perform the topmost pastime of living, lifting the Govardhan hill, in which the highest manifestations of the laws of bhakti are going to be revealed. So Krishna has to first of all make that ground, the proper ground for explanation of this these esoteric reciprocations. And therefore, making it too short for those who are not too lovers of science or not too keen for understanding science, scientific, we have left all and we have come here. But nevertheless, this continues to hound us in the Bhagavatam also, where it is explained in the purport that mechanistic science is explained by Krishna himself. So definitely we have to hear or understand what Krishna is explaining, even the atheistic theory. Therefore, jnanam vijnanam cha, we have to understand both. So Krishna is balancing the ajnan also along with jnan. So similarly, the scientists have understood that object, matter reduced to atom and atom reduced to electron. Electrons are again isolated as electricity, disembodied, means not connected with the particle, existing independent of that electron, is what is the final reality. And now, when they have understood this thing, they relate that we can't understand the matter because the matter is nothing, is out of their grasp. Devamita Maharaj writes in his book, Searching for Vedic India, and he writes that after concluding the essence of their research, they have concluded that an atom is 99.99% empty space. That means they have discovered atom is nothing. Right? And therefore, but how will this be subject to law? How can something be subject to law if it is nothing? Therefore, they have an indeterminacy. First of all, they cannot find out what is the reality. So their first presumption has failed. They have failed to understand the nature of the matter. While in bhakti, in fact, what the scientists say that this material world, which has been taken as a, in fact, the modern physics has concluded that it is not atom, it is not matter, it is energy now. And then when they conclude this quantum physics, they say that actually consciousness is as fundamental as matter is derivative of from consciousness. So they have concluded the bhakti science. Their research has concluded the conclusions of bhakti that atom is nothing but consciousness. The finite, the most simplified particle of this universe is consciousness. And that's what the Bhagavatam and the Padma Puran says, Eka deshe sitaknagir josna vistarani yatha parasya brahmana shaktir vividhevana shruyate. That means the source is at one place and the energy is radiating from that source all over the place. Parasya brahmana shakti. Shakti means energy. So they have concluded that is energy, but now they have not understood the source of that energy. So that's still an incomplete science. Secondly, is the Bhagavatam also explains that how this energy has to be discovered, the process of discovering that energy. It is already explained that energy is from one place, distributed everywhere as consciousness from the Supreme Absolute Truth. But how can this energy be visible to a researcher, a bhakti researcher? Explaining that just as in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam is explained, just as the application of a good ointment over an eye is slowly cleansed and made capable of seeing finer objects, while if someone has any deficiency of vision, so when an ointment is applied, the eye can see finer objects, like now we use spectacles to see those objects clearly. But the Vedic times, they didn't used to have spectacles, they used to have ointment. So the Bhagavatam explains, if you put an ointment, you don't have to go to an ophthalmologist to make the correction of your vision. Similarly, a soul of a devotee is gradually purified by listening to my beautiful divine narratives, and therefore is able to see the subtle principle of mine. This is the bhakti science, to see, to research into the basis of existence, that is consciousness. And therefore Prahlad Maharaj would see everywhere Krishna, in the pillar, in the cobra, in the elephant, in the ocean, in the poison. Mirabai was told to take poison, and she could see that this poison is actually Krishna's grace. Ramanacharya took that Charnamrit, and he was seeing, this is Krishna's grace. And that's how these people could, these great souls, these great bhakti scientists could see by the dint of their purified vision. And therefore, now that it is concluded that this mechanistic science cannot reduce and come to a conclusion of what matter is, and bhakti science has proved that the finite, the most insignificant element or the most reducible element of nature is consciousness, and that consciousness is able to be perceived by the purification of one's heart, which is actually the scientific hypothesis, that you have to purify the self in isolation from all the impurities, greed, envy, lust, anger, pride, and then subject that purified soul in contact with Krishna. And that is the process of devotional service. And now when you see that, the behavior, now just as they have understood that electrons are independent of everyone, they are not governed by any law or motion. So now if you consider that, similarly the soul, the consciousness, is also independent, free will. But in this case, the bhakti science, both God and man are subject, are free will, they are free, but they are still bound by laws. And actually, what is that bonding? That bonding is, both are bound in love, not in law. So the law of bhakti begins with love. And it is explained, very nice. The God of bhakti is not creator, destroyer or maintainer of the universe. He is none but the coward boy who loves to dance the tune of the milkmaid, coward girls of Braj. That is his identity. Therefore, he is governed, naham aham bhakta paradhino, hi asvantara hi dvicha. I am not free in the least. That is Krishna's conclusion. A devotee is bound completely in love with the Supreme Lord, and Krishna is bound in complete love with the devotee. Both are bound by love, and they lose their independent will in the course of interacting the bhakti science. And therefore, this leads to conclusion that just as the matter is so indeterminate, sometimes it behaves as wave, sometimes as a particle, as per the conclusion of the scientists. Therefore, they call it wavicles. That means they are not wave, they are not particles. And because they are having a dual existence in one object, therefore their reaction to the various forces of nature is indeterminate. And therefore Heisenberg, the scientist, propagated a law of uncertainty. What is that? It's called Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Principle is called uncertainty. Can you imagine? This is called science. Their principle is uncertainty. And therefore, the bhakti science is a certainty principle. And therefore, all the acharyas, Vyasdev, Shukdev Goswami, they have enumerated the certainty principle in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And therefore, one should know that these are the laws that govern the consciousness and the super consciousness. And what are the three laws? Law of gravitation may fail. It may fail to attract an object to the earth. But the law of attraction of bhakti can never fail. Just like an iron filing is drawn irresistibly to the magnet, similarly the soul is in its pure, isolated, unmixed form, is naturally attracted to Krishna. And that is the law of attraction. So just as there is law of gravitation in science, there is a law of attraction in bhakti. And therefore this is how, and therefore there are three laws that are certain. The first law is the law of reciprocity. Law of reciprocity. That means according to which the Supreme Lord reciprocates to the devotional attitude of the bhakta. And this is explained in the Bhagavad Gita. Ye yathamam parpadyante tam sateva bhajamyam mama vartmanam anuvartante manushya partha sarvasha. The second law is the law of total self-surrender. According to which the Supreme Lord absolves a bhakta, the devotee, of all the sins, and the moment he surrenders completely to that Supreme Lord. Sarva dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam vaja aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshyasmi ma sucha. The second law. And the third law is the law of exclusive meditation. According to which the Lord provides the means and the end to bhakti to a bhakta who is exclusively and incessantly meditating on the Lord. And the verse that is there is ananyas chintayanto mam ye jana paripasate tesham nitya abhyuktanam yogakshemam vahamyam. These are the three laws of bhakti which are certain, which are sure. And we'll see in the pastime of Chitraketu Maharaj when he was flying in his airplane surrounded by the Gandharva women with their dharas. He was he was seeing Lord Shiva sitting with Parvati Devi amidst the assembly of sages, and they were all hearing from the discourses of Lord Shiva. But Lord Shiva was having Parvati seated on his lap, and he had an arm embracing Parvati Devi. And as he was seeing this, the first thing was wonder. Lord Shiva is such a controlled sage. He is the supreme spiritual master of the whole universe. And how is that, you know, he is wonderfully, you know, exhibiting this posture in front of an assembly of very renowned sages. And then the second thing which leads to him is a kind of bewilderment. This is how a person can become bewildered. He was thinking from the point of view of those who are not able to understand the position of Lord Shiva. Just like an ordinary common man, he is behaving like this. And then third was appreciation. How wonderful is Lord Shiva, even though he is such a great sage, such a great supreme. He is the supreme spiritual master of all the sages. He is the most renowned of everyone. Still he can do this without difficulty. And therefore he did it all this in laughing and wonder and criticizing a little bit. He was not like Daksha, who did not know the position of Lord Shiva, and therefore he offended Lord Shiva. There was a difference between the offense and the criticism of Chitraketu Maharaj and Daksha Prajapati. Daksha Prajapati was filled with envy. With his envious attitude, he was trying to belittle Lord Shiva. And therefore there's a category of offense. The category of offense which leads to one is one which is filled with envy and want to bring the other person down, is a very grave offense, will lead to the destruction of devotional service. Therefore Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he gave love of Godhead to everyone except the very determined offenders who are envious of the devotees. Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda, they were roaming through the streets of Navadvip after having come from Gaya. And they were visiting the places, and they happened to visit the house of a sannyasi. And that when they met the sannyasi, he was happy. Oh, they are very happy to see you. you two brothers, you are so effulgent looking personalities. Definitely I want to give you something. I want to give a benediction to you. So what benediction? May you attain all the wealth and have the association of the most beautiful women. And Lord Chaitanya, he was like, what's wrong with this person? So how can you say this? And he mildly rebuked this sannyasi for giving this kind of benediction. Then he said, this is how, when people are given good benedictions, upstarts like these, who are very new to philosophy and religion and culture, they dare criticize. And then said, fine, Nityan Prabhu said, no, he's a young, he's just novice. So don't worry, don't take it seriously. He said, nevertheless, you are so wonderful, you are so beautiful, we want to offer you nice food. Please stay here and have food with us. And this sannyasi woman had his wife. And Mahaprabhu was seeing this, and then Nityan Prabhu said, we better rush from here. But then he insisted. So Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda said, we'll go to the bath in the Ganges and come back. So they had a bath and came back. And this sannyasi served nice prasad. And then at the end of it he asked, would you like to have some bliss? Said Nityananda Prabhu, Lord Chaitanya said, what is bliss? He said, Nityananda Prabhu just took Mahaprabhu by the side and said, bliss means liquor. And he said, these are the kind of sannyasis who are the followers of the Shaktas, and their way of reciprocation is to offer bliss. Mahaprabhu, he closed his ears with his two hands and loudly chanted, Vishnu, Vishnu. And just both of them ran from there and just jammed in the Ganges to become purified. And then Srila Vrindavan Das Thakur, he remarks in his wonderful narration of Chaitanya Bhagavat that the Lord was so merciful to this sannyasi, householder sannyasi, that he stayed in the house, he remained there for a long time, and he also had food at his house. But Mahaprabhu would never give such mercy to the offenders of the holy name and the Vaishnavas. Though he was the most degraded in his habits and his attitude, but because he was not envious of the devotees, therefore Mahaprabhu bestowed upon him this causeless mercy. And here we find Chitakita Maharaj was not criticizing out of envy. He criticized just out of wonder, appreciation, and to secure the future generation from misunderstanding Lord Shiva. But nevertheless, he did it. While all the sages and all the other assembled great devotees, they dare not speak anything. And therefore, this is to be understood that Lord wanted Chitraketu Maharaj to become fully redeemed of all his resultant karma very quickly and go back to Godhead immediately in the next lifetime as Vritrasura. So that was the reciprocation of Krishna with his devotees. And therefore, when Bhishma Dev is on the battlefield, is on lying on the bed of arrows, and Yudhishthira Maharaj is coming to see him, and he's asking, that how is that these Pandavas suffered, despite all of them being so pious, religious, and follows the principles of religion, and even Lord Krishna being as their close aid and well-wisher and their protector. And therefore, this should be understood from the point of view of the reciprocation, the law of reciprocation. And Prabhupada mentions the purpose, the Lord's reciprocation should not be considered to be under the law of karma. It belongs to the transcendental situation in which the Lord and his devotees function. Both function in that transcendental situation apart from the laws of karma. And devotional service to the Lord is not an activity of this material world, it is a part of the spiritual world. And simply by this understanding, the transcendental affection of the Lord with his devotees, by which the Lord puts his devotees in such a difficult condition, by which a devotee has no other recourse to take but exclusive shelter and submit to the law of self-surrender. The reciprocation law leads to the law of total self-surrender. And therefore, Chitraketu Maharaj did not respond, did not react, did not violate. While Parvati Devi, she cursed Chitraketu Maharaj, seeing his impudent attitude. She noted there was not envy, there was a little bit of pride there. That offense was because of pride, without envy. I am the best. I have seen Lord Vishnu just now and coming. What is this Lord Shiva doing? It's not good, you know. I know how to, what is the ideal standard. And therefore if I see nothing not happening to this standard, then definitely I must correct it. So that correction out of that little pride saw that puffed up behavior of this Parvati Devi, saw that behavior and she cursed by saying, Putra, Chitraketu Maharaj, you are a putra. Son, I am not punishing you like a wife of Lord Shiva. You are not a third party that I am punishing you. So Krishna does not punish us by third party. We should know that is Krishna's people only coming to help us. Right? So this is how the situation that is explained, that the Lord's reciprocation is the transcendental situation in which the Lord and his devotees function. It is not under the law of karma. The curse of Parvati Devi was not under the law of karma that she was getting a reaction and she was giving him a curse. Parikshit Maharaj was not being cursed under the effects of the law of karma. It was the Lord's arrangement, it was the Lord's transcendental situation, and that's how it led both of these great souls to enter into self-surrender. The law of self-surrender. And what was the surrender? The surrender was that did not violate, did not provoke, they were not provoked, they did not retaliate, and they tolerated with gratitude. It was not just mere tolerance, no, just biting their teeth, that I just tolerate. Taro River Saishna was filled with gratitude. And she's saying, your mother, she's saying putra, she's cursing the putra by curse, and is accepting the curse by saying mother. This is how a devotee's self-surrender process with intolerance and in complete gratitude. And therefore, in the sense that Chitraketu Maharaj, he accepted the curse, he accepted and he said this is definitely, and he accepted with all gratitude and he simply boarded his plane. He's saying that this is just that the waves of river, this happiness and distress comes like waves. And they do not remain for a long time because they are in flow. What remains is our devotion service to Krishna, and these happiness and distress do not interfere with the function of devotion service. That is the meaning of law of self-surrender. And therefore, as a result of this, Chitraketu Maharaj became Vitrasura in his next life. And what was his fervor as a demon? He was a devotee at heart, but he was a demon in profession. And sometimes devotees say, we go to the world outside, how do we maintain our balance? He said, Vritrasura is the example. Fight like a demon. But when you come back, or what you are internally, is your heart of a devotee. So he simply fought as a very professional demon. He did not spare Indra's soldiers, nor he spared Indra also. But when he performed his duty, it was with full vigor, but with the heart of a soft devotee. So we will find that Srila Prabhupada established this Krishna consciousness movement with the heart of a devotee and a fist of an iron hand in one sense. He did not compromise in his acts of presenting Krishna consciousness very uncompromisingly, very fiercely, very rigidly, very strongly, in face of all opposition. At the same time, he had a heart of a Bengali mother. Right? And therefore, this law of exclusive meditation is something which a devotee lives internally but externally applies with great vigor, very bewildering to even great people in this world. So Vritrasura was completely confusing personality. Even to Indra could not comprehend him. Being so close with him, hearing sermons from him, seeing him directly, he was speaking like Bhagavad Gita philosophy, and he was telling to fight. He was at the same time gobbling all these soldiers. So it was completely incomprehensible. But this is how the law of exclusive meditation teaches to perform our duty with great responsibility, whatever we may have. In fact, this one nice story is there as to how one should follow one's occupation, but one should be rooted in one's strong identity of following the principles of dharma. Occupation may be compromising, but the principle of one's integrity and one's personal life should be filled with devotion and integrity. There's a Brahman, this story mentioned by Loma Sarvashi too, I think so, with Yudhishthira Maharaj. It's talking about a Brahman named Kaushik. He was a Brahman and he was a little angry Brahman. So once a female crane passed stool on his head as he was sitting under a tree. Immediately he cursed and this female crane died. He was disturbed. He got up, went to house to beg. And a lady appeared on the door. She said, "Mother, please give something. Please give me something. I need some food, grains." She went inside, but her husband came at the same time, and she began busily serving her husband. And by the time she came out, after serving her husband, doing everything for the husband very nicely, as a chaste lady would do, this Kaushik was again angry. He said, "Do you not understand the religious principles of offering sacrifice and charity to a Brahman?" The wife said, "I am not," and he was about to curse again, angry. He said, "I am not like that female crane that you cursed. I did my duty as a chaste wife serving husband. That is my first dharma. So I have done my dharma. And now I can satisfy you without hesitation. And if you want to understand principles of religion, go to the butcher in Mithila and learn principles of conduct from him." He is shocked. But he's shocked because he's also at the same time knowing that, she knows female crane also. Story. Something intimately which happened. And Paramatma only knew. How come she knew? So she must be a visionary. She must know something. She has understood. So then he went to Mithila. And in Mithila, he went to search for the butcher who was selling meat. He went to the butcher and said, "How is this person? But let me ask about the principles of religion from him." He said, "Please come." And he brought him to his house. He was so cultured and he was serving his elderly parents with great respect and attention. And he's saying that, "I don't myself kill, but this is my profession. This is what is handed over to me. I don't personally kill, but I simply engage in selling the meat. But I value my service to my parents the highest, my elderly parents. And because of that, of following my dharma rigidly, I am still not implicated because of my compromising occupation." And therefore, then he said, "But you must be a great soul. There must be some story to your past." He said, "Yes. I was born as a Brahmana. I was actually engaged in fighting, going with the king. I was going with the king one day for hunting. And I happened to shoot a rishi by mistake. And he cursed me to be born as a butcher in my next life. But will retain my principles and will retain my integrity in course of living as a life as a butcher. So externally I may be like a butcher, but internally my heart is following dharma. My dharma, what my occupation duty is. And because of that, I need not fear consequences of hell." Kaushik, the Brahman, who was supposed to be a Brahman, tolerant, non-violent, peaceful, realized his mistake. And he also started to understand the principles of his own occupational duties from the lady and this butcher. And this is how Yudhishthira Maharaj was convinced by Bhishma Dev later to rule the kingdom as a very responsible Kshatriya. Though he was wanting to give up this occupation because of the immense grief that he was facing. So there is nothing in this world higher than one's following one's own dharma and not giving up for seeing any fault in the profession. And that's how Bhagavad Gita also explains. Even though one's duty may be filled with so many faults, one must not abandon it to perform the duties of others. And the bhakti science deals with the law of reciprocation, the law of existence of the soul, reciprocation of reciprocity, the law of self-surrender, and the law of exclusive meditation. When one follows one's occupation duties very rigidly, firmly. At the same time, one engages one mind and senses in serving the Lord exclusively in meditation. And this is the little bit of understanding of mechanistic science. I was thinking what to speak on this topic, but I'm sorry if I really spoke which was very irrelevant, but all our inclinations, scientific inclinations, have to be dovetailed in Krishna's service. But this philosophy is explained by Krishna in the Bhagavatam, the mechanistic science, but ultimately bring out the bhakti science, because he wanted to reciprocate with the Vrajvasis and want to curb down the pride of Indra. While curbing the pride of Indra, he would get an opportunity to become Giridhari, and the law of reciprocation can go unhindered for 7 days and seven nights. So this philosophy was spoken to actually engage in the bhakti science fully. Krishna explained the mechanistic science to fully expound the bhakti science as a law of reciprocation for 7 days and seven nights with all the Brajvasis under one shelter, Giriraj. Wanted reciprocity also with Giriraj for his services. So imagine, Giriraj was being constantly in touch with Krishna 7 days and seven nights, and therefore, because Giriraj completely surrendered, even the thunderbolts of Indra would not make any difference, because the exclusive meditation of being in touch with Krishna was so powerful, so uncompromising, that it was just like humid showers, a spray that was happening just to exhaust the heat of Govardhan Hill that was facing. So this is a small understanding. Any questions in this regard? Anyways, it's late. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.